And this is Jeff Stanwell on Radio Northern Beaches 88.7 and 90.3 FM. And I am delighted, absolutely delighted, and privileged, so as I said on Facebook, on social medias, to have in the studio an old friend who used to be in the police. He's now, what are you doing there? Bugger all.
I'm a granddad, Jeff. Pretty well a granddad, a retired pensioner, I suppose you could say.
Okay. Let's go back to the beginning. Alan and I first met, we were just saying off air that it was probably in 2012. Alan came into the studio when I was at another station with Superintendent Rob Critchlow, and I think that Superintendent Jeff Philippi was there as well. And Alan's gone on to do heaps and heaps of other things, which always amaze me for a man who's approaching 50.
you're very kind there. I got a story behind that. I went and bought my vegetables the other day, and this lady, as I'm leaving, said, "Oh, by the way, sir, I gave you the seniors discount on that." I didn't love it. I'm still getting over it.
You're at that age where you can sort of go between the being a young man and someone who's about to get old, especially with the grandkids around.
Yes.
Okay, I was going to read the back page of the book, which, here we go, the blurb. It's a bit of a connection. Anyway, in a world full of leaders who put their egos first and crave power in the spotlight, here's a story about a leader, i.e. Alan Sickard, my guest, who did exactly the opposite in the autocratic arena of policing. Did you read this?
Yes.
Very good, mate. Can you pull the mic just towards you?
Yes.
That's it. This is a story about Alan Sickard, a leader who empowered others to lead. Alan Sickard was a New South Wales police officer for 40 years and police commander for the last 15 years of that career. During this time, he's renowned for creating a workplace where people did their best, working together. Gosh, you and I are like, we're going to get into some of the most challenging crises Australia has ever seen, including the Mossman collar bomb in 2011 and the first 2 hours of the Lindt Cafe siege in 2015. This is a different book about leadership, leadership where mistakes are made, leadership where mistakes are learnt from. Over a period, Alan Sickard developed a leadership style that created a workplace and a community where people do their best because they know they are trusted, included, supported and cared for. You know that years ago, I used to be in the army as an officer in the military police. And when I came into officer cadet school, the first thing they did was sent me to an artillery unit. And the commanding officer of that particular artillery unit was a bit of a tyrant. But I was there, and I was a brand new officer with very shiny pip on my shoulder. And he said, "Okay, what we're going to do now is we're going to build a command post, and that's 6 foot deep and 6 foot wide, or maybe, I can't remember what the precise dimensions were." And I said, "Oh, good idea. Okay, let's do it." So we got the men, threw them into the hole, not literally, but put them into the hole with spades and things. We started digging, and I thought, "Okay, this is good." So I jumped in the hole with them and started digging. Within about 3 or 4 minutes, the commanding officer came out and said, "Mr. Stanwell," in the most autocratic way, "get out of that hole. You're not another rank. You're an officer now, and you can't do that. You've got to..."
Yeah.
Whereas I believe that if I was ordering men,
yes,
to get in and do something, I should be able to get in there and do it myself and just sort of show them.
Yes.
So in that, do you understand what I'm...
I totally understand what you're talking about. Yes. Yeah.
So, in a way, there's quite a few similarities between the police and the military, isn't there? I mean, based on ranks and things and officers and...
Yeah, you start off as... I started off as a trainee. It was called a trainee, or some people call it cadets, and you go all the way from probationary constable, first class constable, not that doesn't exist anymore, senior constable,
right.
Sergeant. There's a few levels of senior sergeant, then inspector, chief inspector, superintendent, chief superintendent, and then assistant commissioner, and then commissioner.
Commissioner.
Deputy commissioner. There's three deputies, I think, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Very, very similar to the Army or the Air Force or the Navy.
Yes, yeah.
Would you go back to the Academy now? Or I mean, you'd find things very, very different to what you did when you were there. Was it 1980?
1980, we passed out of the Redfern Police Academy.
Now occupied by horses.
Yes, and some, I think there's a religious...
A specialist group.
So there's a religious kind of temple there as well out the front, yeah.
Is
it? Yeah, I think there is. Yeah. We were there the other day. My wife just had her 40-year police reunion with some of her counterparts, and we went to the Cleveland... I think it was the Burke Street Hotel, down on the corner. And we parked outside the police academy. So it was just so...
Did you wander in?
No. But it was just...
Do you still have something that would identify you if you wanted to do something like that? I mean, could you reach into your wallet and produce an ex-police officer badge or something?
No, I've had this experience. We were talking off-air before today started, and... Last year, I helped coach a lot of the new fighters for the Police Legacy Boxing competition last year. And every Wednesday morning at 6 a.m., we went for about three or four months. Myself and another coach, Ian Gardner.
Hello, Ian. Loved you coming on Facebook, Ian.
He and I went to the Sydney Police Centre, which is at Surry Hills. And when I went there, quite often I wasn't allowed in. I had to really use my persuasive, pleading, begging voice. I'm here to coach some guys and girls. Can you please let me in? Because I'm pretty ex, I suppose you could say.
Yeah, I understand. But the security people are now, they're not sworn officers, are they? But the police.
They're called special police.
So they've got the rank of special constable.
Yes, yes, okay. Yes. So some of them knew me, some of them didn't. I had no animal. I'll work out a way of doing it better next year or this year.
Okay. We're chatting with. I don't like saying ex superintendent, but is there any other way? I mean, sometimes going back to the military thing. If you left as a major, if you left the military, they'd straight away make you a lieutenant colonel, retired sort of thing. So they haven't said to you, Alan Sickard, we're going to make you chief superintendent, retired or anything.
They don't do that. I know there's some, because there's so much social stuff like nowadays. A lot of people will just call themselves retired. If you want to hang on to that old. That old rank.
In brackets, RET.D.
Yeah. So that's, I mean, retired police officer, Alan Sickard. It's fine.
Okay. Tell us about the boxing, because I have put it out there, and Ian has liked it. He claims that you're not, or you claim that you're not accomplished in boxing.
Oh, not at all.
How many bouts did you in fact fight?
I had two fights, official fights. Yeah. So in 2014 was my first... foray into police boxing, and I only did that because there was a group of us, Alan Clark, Tony Crandell and a few others, that would go down every Tuesday and Thursday mornings in the police cells underneath Surry Hills, and we had these what was called an old man boxing fitness. Fitness, but it was the old man thing was really a poor indication about how tough it was.
Okay.
So then police legacy boxing...
So tell me the ages...
About
the same.
Yeah, we're all in our mid-50s by that stage, or some. Tony Crandall was in his still late 40s.
Right.
And there's some younger people there, like sergeants and and even constables. They wanted to come in and just do the sessions with the old guys. And then...
Females too?
Yeah, some of them were fierce, really, really fierce, yeah.
Letting the tension out.
Yeah, they were very confident. So out of that came the opportunity to my friend Tony Crandell and my mentor and friend Alan Clark, retired assistant commissioner Alan Clark, had fought the year before, and I thought, why don't I have a go? And it turned out Alan Clark, he used to meet me every Tuesday morning in the little ring in the cells, and he's a huge man. He's 20 kilograms heavier than me, with a big busted nose on him.
That's
not... no, that happened in football. But he was a very kind man. And he used to laugh. He said, I love boxing with you, Al, because your head doesn't move. So that tells you how good I was, or not how very good I was. The guy I fought the first year was another superintendent. He's still in, as far as I know. Peter McElhone. And he's
got a busted nose
now. No. I'm a lover, not a fighter. Yeah. And his fight name was Silver.
Did you
ever fight mine? Because I'm not a very... I didn't take it seriously because I'm not a very fierce or scary man. So my fight name was Alan Buttercup Sickard. So I'd seen Peter Silver McElhone boxing, and he was pretty fierce, and I thought, I'm going to get killed. So I reached out, one of my sergeants, you probably know him, at North Sydney at the time, a fellow called Chris Patrice.
Oh, yes.
He's a phenomenal boxer.
Right.
So he undertook to help me, and then there was... A boxing coach at the North Sydney PCYC.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Who had
down
in
Falcon Street.
Yeah, who had trained world level champions, a bloke called Mark Pitts. He took me on, and he straight away. I described how Peter McElhone fought. Like, he come forward all the time and fiercely.
Yeah.
So Mark Pitts, my trainer, taught me what he called the Matador move. So you just, they charge you, you step out of the way, you hit them on the way through, and then reset.
So,
yeah, so that's essentially what I did.
So from the day when the actual bouts took place, if you go backwards, how many months did you take
to
do the training, Alan?
4, 5 to 6 months probably. It was a long, because I was hopeless. I was really hopeless. And then because I'm a southpaw, that's anyone that doesn't know, left-handed, that makes me maybe a little bit difficult to deal with. And I started to, and I'm not a heavyweight puncher,
right.
but it's, I learned that boxing's kind of timing.
Right.
So if they were walking forward when I was throwing it, because the better you get, the more you sense that something's coming.
Right.
So I would just throw it, and I'd hit them, and I'd wonder, what happened? How did that happen? and they would be sitting there. And so I ended up, I was probably moving forward pretty quickly. 2 weeks before the fight against Peter McElhone, I got in the ring with this guy that had a reputation of breaking people's ribs. He's 20 kilograms heavier than me. And I got in there, and the first round, I just annoyed him. And in the second round, he said, I'm going to sort you out, and he broke my rib.
Truly.
Yeah. So 2 weeks out, I have a broken rib.
The interesting thing, Alan, is whether he breaks the same rib for every person.
I don't know. Everyone heard it. When it happened, they went, are you all right, Alan? So somehow I conned my doctor into signing me off to...
What, strapped, heavily strapped?
No, it came good. It just came...
Did it?
Yeah, it came good enough. I couldn't... For probably 10 days, I couldn't even lift my hands. I couldn't sneeze. And I kept on doing... And I couldn't... But I could do the Matador move. So I trained for 10 rounds, dancing around the ring, exactly what the Matador spin and turn would be. And then as it got closer, probably 4 days out, I realised I could start throwing my hands again. So I went to my doctor, and he just laughed at me. He said, only you would come and ask me to sign, because he could only see me 10 days before with a broken rib. And he signed me off. Peter McElhone, I'd let him know, the bloke I'm going to fight, that I had a broken rib 2 weeks out. He said, it might get better. I promise you I won't hit you in the ribs. Still fight. So I thought, he's going to be a nice guy. He's not going to hit me. So let's fast forward. We get in the let's. This is the scariest thing. You asked me before the interview.
Yeah.
All the things I've done in the cops, all the big jobs I've ever been to. The scariest thing I've ever done is getting in that boxing ring, because I'm not someone that craves the spotlight. I don't want to be front and center. But when you're in the ring, you're front and center, and there's nowhere else to hide. So I got in the ring.
And there's 500 people watching.
Yeah, was it
cheering?
Yeah, they're all cheering for Silver, not for Buttercup.
Really?
Oh, there were. People were cheering for Buttercup, but they couldn't hear Buttercup over Silver.
Buttercup the cow.
Yeah. And so the fight, the first round happens. And this is in the book, so I'm probably giving this chapter away. But the first round happens, and the Matador move works wonderfully well. And I'm just pissing. Oh, I'm just making. I shouldn't use that word. I'm just making. Silver, Peter McLean, cranky at me. So the next two rounds, and just a little aside in after the first round, I thought, I'm pretty happy with that. You know, I think I've done it. I can go home now.
Were there three rounds?
Three 2 minute rounds. And in that first year, I was allowed to have my son, my 24-year-old, he's 24, 25 at that time, in my corner. So I'm thinking in my head, that first round was pretty good. I can go home now. He can win. It doesn't matter. and my son reaches over the ring, the ropes, and says, "I'm so proud of you, Dad."
Really?
And so I thought, I can't go home now. So
because you had his tears. Right.
Yeah. So I went in, did the next two rounds. Peter McElhane forgot any promises he made to me. He threw me into the corner and was pounded away at my ribs. And I thought I'd lose the fight because this is my first ever fight. So he was pounding. I was pretty good at getting out of the corner because Christmas Priest had taught me how to get out of the corner. But Peter was keeping me in the corner, pounding away. And I turned away. I thought, I don't know.
With your gloves on?
Yeah, I just turned my head away because I didn't know what to do. And the ref cautioned me twice. He said, "You can't do that." I said, "Okay, I understand."
I didn't know that.
Yeah, no, you're not.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, so I thought, well, I've lost the fight. Yeah, I didn't care. I did care, but you know what I mean. I'd done as much as I could.
Right.
I was as courageous as I could be, but I was just in a situation where I didn't know what I was doing, really. And ultimately, the end of the fight, the judges gave me a split decision that I won the fight. And there's a picture in the book. It's priceless. They're lifting my hand and I'm thinking, oh my God, how did that happen?
Yeah.
But Silver's corner in the picture, they're both going, their hands are in there going, it's priceless. Yeah. So that's my foray into boxing. The next year,
this was mainly for Police Legacy.
For all it's a beautiful charity where I think the Army does it, Armed Services does it as well. But if anyone dies in, like the mother or father dies in a police family, that police family will support them for life.
I remember when we were talking, he's now up at Newcastle, Craig Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
He used to come in and we'd sort of support him for the ride on the bicycle ride between Sydney and was it Wollongong or Illawarra or something? Oh no, it was Canberra.
I think they go to Canberra.
Of course it was Canberra. Yeah, and Danny Sullivan.
Yes.
Take part in it. Well, Danny's out at Dubbo.
He's at Dubbo now. Yes.
So the Police Legacy does a lot of good work, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Now the next thing I've got for you, seeing as you've done the boxing and you're making money for people, is the boots.
Yes.
All your idea, or you picked it up from somewhere?
No.
I've got to explain this to you, dear listener, because Alan was, you're sitting there one day and you thought, we've all these boots left over, what are we going to do about them?
Kind of, yeah. If I take you into that aspect of it, you've introduced me as a retired superintendent, so every superintendent in the New South Wales Police Force has a sponsorship.
Right.
So one, and some of that can be drugs, it can be firearms, youth crime.
Right.
And
Mardi Gras.
Yes,
whatever.
So mine, I was sitting in a meeting one day with all these other police commanders and the big boss said, we need a sponsor for homelessness. And everyone just turned the other way because, no one had never been contemplated. But I was at North Sydney at that time, and we just had
known as Harborside.
Harborside. And we just in the last say 2 or 3 months had two gentlemen die in the caves at Waverton. There's caves in the cliffs.
Bull's Head or something.
And they'd been homeless for years, and they essentially died from exposure.
And not found for
maybe a day. Yeah,
okay.
yeah.
yeah.
So I thought, well, how can someone, like that's the one of the most affluent areas in, sure. in Australia.
Sure.
How can someone die of
the
being...
The most fabulous view.
Yeah. So I put up my hand to be the homelessness sponsor. And then I learnt all about it. A professor called Dr. Catherine Robinson had
written... Have you interviewed her?
Yeah, no, not yet.
It's on the list.
She's on the list for sure.
Yeah.
Because I've interviewed quite a few homelessness experts on that on my podcast, the Courage to Lead interview series. So I went and had a coffee with her, much like we're talking now, and she gave me everything you know I needed to know about homelessness. And then all the people I needed to kind of connect with, who were the leaders to make a difference in that space.
Right.
So then I virtually.
So it's not just homelessness within the Harbourside Command. It's throughout the whole New South Wales.
Yeah. Well, sure. I was part of Central Metropolitan Region then, so it was essentially anything that was in that region. It was essentially really that big spotlight was the Sydney CBD.
Right.
So I got to know all those people in that area that were the leaders in homelessness. I saw early on that it was quite disjointed how they approached business. They were all, funded by the government to do different tranches of homelessness. So that kept them essentially separate and restricted their way that they could actually help people. And if you were homeless or at risk of homelessness, it was impossible to navigate your way through that process.
Right.
So in the police, in emergency management, we're pretty good at coordinating different needs, different groups of people.
Different agencies.
Yeah, to work together. So I just used that model and I asked the leaders, would you mind if I chaired a meeting one day of the homelessness people? So then...
How many would there be there?
Up to 50.
Wow.
But I'd learnt through one of the people I interviewed on my podcast series how to do a big meeting and how to include people. So I just created an agenda, let everyone speak. It was an hour meeting, but I promised them we would have actions coming out of the meeting, and those actions were we'd meet up at a hotspot, a homelessness hotspot in the Sydney CBD once every 2 weeks or every month. And through that, our goal was it doesn't matter who houses them, but collectively, we're going to house them. And so we essentially, one of the things that
I'm picturing you down there behind St Mary's Cathedral, perhaps.
Yeah, one of the first ones we did was in Central Railway Station.
Okay.
Yeah, so, and I used to go in jeans and a hoodie, so that no one would know I was a cop, because would shy away from it. And out of that, I remember the first day we found we had our housing person with us, a representative of housing with us, and they gave a homelessness person a 50-page document to fill out.
Are you joking?
That's the procedure.
Are you serious?
That was the procedure. So we went just by working together. We went the lady I was working with was Trina Jones. She's the CEO of Homelessness New South Wales now. And we just went, that's just stupid. So just by working together like that, next time they came out, essentially pretty well within a couple of months, they came out with an iPad and did the application for them, and we could house them then.
Because they needed to be registered.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
So that's a really simple way of saying it. But using that approach, within an 18-months to 2-year period, we housed over 300 people in the Sydney CBD with no extra money, just by working together. Yeah, so, and then that model now, my book talks about this, model now is the model that's used for outreach all over New South Wales in homelessness.
And other states as well?
Potentially. I only relate to that. So then I'm passionate. You can tell just by talking to me, I'm passionate about about homelessness. It shouldn't exist. If we had the right people working together, we could end it.
Okay.
But
I remember you telling me once, and I forget if the numbers have changed, but the number of people on any one night who are homeless within New South Wales is quite staggering. Yeah.
Yes, and I haven't got that data for you at the moment. But so I think the data is there's 35,000 people on the waiting list in New South Wales for a new house.
35,000.
Yeah, for a new house.
And I remember maybe you then went on to say that people think there's no homelessness around Chatswood.
Yes.
Or in the northern beaches.
Yes. So I replicated the model that we were doing in the city. I just replicated what we did in the Sydney CBD on the north side from virtually the Harbour Bridge up to Hornsby, and everywhere in between Manly and everything. Right. And we did the same thing there. We housed hundreds of people just by doing the same thing. So each year, because you can tell you've got me going now. each year there's a homelessness week to shine a light on homelessness.
Are you still involved?
I run a consultancy business, so I just did a job for one of the community housing providers, helping their leadership team and their specialist homeless team to work better together. So I am still involved. I'm still quite passionate about it.
When is the week?
The homelessness week is in August. That's always August.
Can you come back with me and sit in exactly the same chair?
Leading up to it? Yeah, I'll undertake, and I'm sure she'll come, I'll bring the CEO of Homelessness New South Wales.
Well, there's 110,000 people listening to you right now, and there's a promise from Alan.
She'll come. Yeah, she's amazing, Trina Jones, but probably one of the best leaders I've ever worked with. But so, Homelessness Week shines a light on homelessness. So the people that I work with, I think it did happen in this order. I know it happened a little bit differently. So I thought this is when I had the light bulb moment about the boots. Right. So what better way? Because people look at...
I can see this chapter in your book being called Eureka.
It's cool. It's called homelessness. It's a really original name. Okay. It is a Eureka moment. But every police officer has... at least one or two spares of...
You probably turned that around and said, what is it that every police officer has that I can use?
Yes, yeah. And then traditionally police are seen by the most vulnerable as an enemy, not as a friend.
Sure.
So I thought, let's flip that. Let's donate it. So the first year, Mission Australia, the guy is now a councillor in the Goulburn City Council down in Goulburn in New South Wales. Mm-hmm. Daniel Strickland was...
Rich Lowe's old.
Where I got married there. So he was the guy that took all my boots and organised around the state for Mission Australia to collect from the police stations that wanted to take part. And he showed me pictures of giving the boots from Harbourside, North Sydney's police station to guys who didn't have shoes in Belmore Park in Sydney. And that one of those photos is in the book. It's just priceless. So then out of that, it grew some legs. So then I created the same homelessness support model on the north side. So the team of people that I work with on the north side of the harbour were quite phenomenal. And they said, well, why don't we do it to raise awareness of Homelessness Week? Why don't we do a 24-hour relay across the Sydney Harbour Bridge?
Wow.
But they said, we don't know how to do it. I said, well, I know how to do it. I do New Year's Eve every year, so I know the people. So I asked the question. They said, yes, you can do it. And so for three years running, because it was a big commitment, we did a 24-hour relay with school kids, with homeless support services, with anyone that wanted to be involved in it, just walking across the bridge for 24 hours. And we mixed that with, because the main...
This is on the main deck.
On the Opera House side.
Right.
And the main organiser that helped me with that was Rochelle Elphick in Mission Australia.
Right.
So she was my conduit to continuing the Mission Australia angle of it. And then I think it's Sunrise. What's the two shows on...
Whatever.
One of those news shows, they came and interviewed us on the deck of the Harbour Bridge one of those years. So it was all about just raising, because my biggest thing about homelessness, I've researched, I've given speeches to different groups of people, I think the data, when I looked it up, is 4 out of every 10 Australians think that homeless people deserve it.
Right.
Because they don't want to catch it. But it's not. Like, what I've learned is all of us are really maybe 1 or 2 or 3 life events away from being homeless. If there's so many stories there, but if your parent is mentally ill, if your parents separate because of domestic violence, you can be pretty well. Family can be homeless pretty quick.
Very easy. Okay, I'm going to have a quick break. It's up to you, Alan Sicker, except Alan Sicker, to choose a song. What would you like me to find for you and put to air?
I don't know whether it promotes the book all that well, but there's this chapter that talks about where I create ringtones for particular people that ring me.
No.
So do you want to play Bon Jovi, Bad Medicine?
Oh.
That might make people read the book. Who's that ringtone for?
We'll find this and we'll put it to air. Here we go.
That's it.
Bad Medicine, Bon Jovi. And this is Jeff Stern on Radio Northern Beaches 88.7 and 90.3 FM. And I am delighted to have in the studio with me an old friend, Superintendent Alan Sicard, who was the commander of North Shore Police Area Command until he retired in November 2020.
You're spot on.
November 2020, exactly, almost precisely to the day. It was 40 years since he joined in 1980.
Yep.
You wouldn't survive if you went back to the academy now, would you?
I don't think so. No. I mean, I ended up fitter than I ever was, but I think being a...
That's what I meant to ask you, with all your boxing that you did. With the boxing that you did, you must have been very fit.
Fitter than I've ever been. Yeah. And we continued that. The book talks about this, my book, The Courage to Lead, Resilience and Compassion in Police Command, due out for release on the 27th of June
2023. We're not advertising. It's Courage to Lead. And the official launch, we're sort of doing a semi-launch today.
Yeah.
But the official launch is June 27th.
So the fitness part of it, and I talked about it when, you know, we were training in the cells underneath Surry Hills Police Station. So I replicated that in North Sydney and then in North Shore Police Area Command in the Chatswood Police Station. We ended up with a thing called No Rank on the Roof. So Chatswood Police Station's got a roof, top area.
I've done that course there, and we examined the cells and everything, but I didn't know there was something on the roof.
There's a really nice area on the roof. So every Tuesday and Thursday since 2017, when I was appointed the commander of that new command, we had this boxing fitness session there called No Rank on the Roof, and it got quite popular because part of that session was you got to, you know, hit the boss as hard hard as you could. So
were you there with the gloves on?
Yeah. We weren't fighting. We were doing pad work.
Oh, okay.
I
do that every Thursday down at the War Beds, and it's taxing.
So we are, by the end, some of those men and women that I train with were so fit that they lifted my fitness and mental health and my enjoyment.
We were talking earlier about homelessness and especially how homeless people seem to gravitate towards the CBD of Sydney, but there is also homelessness in Manly,
yes,
and in Chatswood and in Hornsby, I'd imagine,
yes,
and sort of all over the state. But when you were there in the city, how did it come about that you were the police commander on the ground for the Winter Cafe?
That's probably a pretty good segue into probably what the book's about. I'll answer your question straight off about that. So Mick Fuller was Assistant Commissioner. Mick Fuller in charge of Central Metropolitan Region at that time.
Right.
He wanted to give the then police commander of Sydney City an opportunity to relieve at another rank in another region.
Yep.
So he asked me if I would look after Sydney City for 3 months. So that was from...
temporary.
Yeah, it was only from...
New boy on the block.
Yeah, so, and that's... I expect one of your listeners or many of your listeners might correct what I supplied you about. The Link Cafe happened in 2014. That's my typo in that back blurb, which I've fixed it since I've given it to you. So between December 2014 and February 2015, I was the commander looking after Sydney City. so I was the guy that happened to be there when the Link Cafe happened. But
same rank.
Yeah.
The crown on the tip on your shoulder.
I was a superintendent, but I was just looking after the place for 3 months while the other their substantive commander was away. I did that quite a few places.
Any in the country?
No, I did. I call the big four. I made Redfern, Surrey Hills, King's Cross, the city, and I also did Maroubra, Eastern Beaches,
and Harbourside, and North Shore.
Yes.
Okay. Sorry, mate.
So the story behind how did the Link Cafe happen and why...
What's the very first indication you had that something was wrong?
All right. So that particular day, I can't even remember the day now. It's a day in December. I think it's the 15th of December. Just a really fine day. Right. I'm driving across the Sydney Harbour Bridge to an emergency management meeting in North Sydney that I was still going to chair.
So heading north,
but I had the police radio on. And the job came over the police radio straight away. An inspector that he's now a superintendent, probably one of the best operational police I've ever worked with, a bloke called Tony Bell, got on the air and said, I think we've got something going on at the Link Cafe. We're getting reports of a man taking hostages with a rifle. We've heard that he's got a backpack on I'm pretty sure this is, I learnt that at that time, potential device in it.
Right.
And as confirmation, we normally get our coffee from there, but they're not picking
up. Oh, so we're something well
known.
They're throwing the free chocolate.
Oh, I don't know. And they're not answering the phone. So it was real. You could tell it was real straight off.
Right.
So I got on the air pretty well straight away. I did a U-turn.
I'm going to say, come on, Al. I'm in the middle of the Harbour Bridge. You did a U-turn.
Yeah, well, there's a way to do it. You get off on the northern exit, Brook Street, I think it is, and just come back again. So I knew how to do it. So I do a U-turn, go back over the Harbour Bridge, I get on the air. And because I'd been the police commander for the Mossman collar bomb with Madeleine Pulver in 2011, I knew straight away what I wanted to create, that could be created without me being there, and I could offload some of the responsibility. So I got on the air and said, this is Sydney City 1. I've heard that job. I'm on my way to take over command. Can I ask you to do two things? And I said to this police radio, I'm requesting that the traffic commander for the Central Metropolitan Region, an inspector, get on the air, go to that job, and create an inner perimeter that closes down the job. The second thing I want him to do is create an outer perimeter that lets the rest of the city function. Because we can't shut the city down.
Thinking on that, if you had to pinpoint a precise location, which was the centre of the city of Sydney, could it be around the Link Cafe?
Close. Well,
either there or the town hall.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, if you look at it from a strategic point of view, it's directly opposite Channel 7.
Yeah.
And on top of Channel 7 is what's called...
Did that come into play?
Yeah. And directly on top of Channel 7 is where the Premier...
All laid out.
So you could say it's in the centre of
Sydney.
And I think the Reserve Bank is very close to there as well. So it's the central hub. Just go for it. So he did. So that guy did that. He set up his launching point. He's
did he arrive on scene before you?
Not long after. He never came to me. He used Hyde Park as his staging point.
Right.
And so all the Highway Patrol, all the different cops that went to help started off there pretty well. So he did that, and I asked for another thing that I'd learnt. So I'd learnt those skills from the Mossman Collarbomb.
Right.
Exactly that. And then the second thing I learnt from the Mossman Collarbomb was a thing called the trauma plan. So at the Mossman Collarbomb, I held hourly meetings with all the stakeholders around what are we going to do next. And I remember the ambulance commander at the time, a beautiful lady called Simone Locke, said, Alan, we need to do a trauma plan. I said, what's a trauma plan? What do you mean? And she said, well, if that device goes bang, we need a plan about how we're going to help all the people that's affected.
Right.
So I asked on air on my way over the Sydney Harbour Bridge. Can you get the ambulance commander to do that? And what I didn't know, because I'm not a terrorism trained commander at that time. Right. I was later on, but I didn't know that when the tactical operations unit down the TOU deploy, they take the paramedics with them, so they're already thinking about a trauma plan. So I didn't know that. That was my ignorance. So the next thing I did then, travelling across the bridge, as I rang Mick Fuller, he's the Assistant Commissioner of Central Med at that time. I said, boss, this is what's happening. I think it's real. He said, and I gave him what was happening. He said, thanks for the phone call.
Yeah.
And this is the power of kind of what my book's about, you know, working on your own. You can't do much, but with a group of committed people with some serious skills, you can do a lot. Mate, so what?
It's the camaraderie.
Yeah. So what Mr. Fuller did from that phone call, like he's on level 7 of the Sydney Police Centre in Surry Hills. He packs up his office from level 7, goes to level 4 where the Police Operations Centre is that we use to run all the big jobs, and he set up an incident command team full of other superintendents and a critical friend who was Tony Crandell. To help him run the first 2 hours of the Link Cafe. So just by that phone call. So this is a pretty good segue into what the book's about.
Right.
So the book is about, like, how did...
The way that you describe it is extremely smooth, the way that things unfolded up until that point.
Yes.
Everything happens very smoothly. Everybody knows what their place is and they're in their place.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I won't spoil it because there's a whole lot of other things that happen in that 2 hours, and I encourage you to read the book about what those pressures were, how the team went, and what the flow on from that was.
Yeah.
But how does what I wrote the book about is essentially not all of us are going to be a CEO or a commissioner or a prime minister.
Sure.
Most of us are just going to be like ordinary old Alan Sickard. Just working for people, trying to create the best environment you can where people feel supported, included, so they can do their absolute best.
Right.
My journey to leadership was I had some great moments, but I had some horrible, horrible failures.
You're not saying you're a failure.
No. I had some horrible failures up to before I was the commander of the Link Cafe and the Collarbomb. So my lead up to making the jump from being a sergeant in the cops to an inspector in the cops, and I think you talked about this. You gave the example right at the start.
You're
leading from the front.
Yep.
But once you become the next level up, the superintendent,
yeah.
If you're always leading from the front, and I read a book about this, because when you write a book, you start, what else is out there around what I'm going to talk about?
Research.
So I read this book, and I wish I'd found it ages ago. It's called What Got You Here Won't Keep You There. And essentially, all this, and this is what you talked about at the start of that, so it's a really good segue in. As a sergeant and as an inspector, if I saw something that needed to change, I'd change it. And I could influence the change, and I was always protected by an inspector or a superintendent or someone above me to have that support. But when I became a superintendent, I had all these other leaders that were supposed to do that for me.
Of a higher rank.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So what, and I, one of the chapters in the book is called The Good, the Bad and the Ugliness of Failure.
Ah.
And so I learnt that, and as a new leader, and I'm not unique at this, well, I think I'm not going to name names, but at a political level,
yeah,
and at a kind of a high profile level, you can see leaders that fell into the trap that I did. When you're a brand new leader, you're keen. You want to get into it. So my first command, and I won't talk about where it was, but I stuffed up. I was too keen. I became a leader of one. I put a target on my back, and the debilitation of failing really knocked me around. And I've really considered leaving.
The job.
It was. And the chapter talks. The chapter talks about how debilitating this period was. So what the book's about is you can fail. But if you want to write your own story, yeah, and if you have support, if you seek out mentors and coaches and do
your research.
And acknowledging, not blaming other people, but acknowledging the role you played in that failure,
yeah,
with the goal that you're going to improve. And my goal always was, I just want to be the best leader I can be that creates an environment where people feel supported and included to do their best. So that's what the book's about. So
how inspirational is that?
I did fail a number of times. I was told last chance, Alan, quite a few times as a superintendent. And I was told, I was counselled as a superintendent more times than I've ever been counselled in my whole life for mistakes.
Who does the counselling? A higher rank? We're not talking psychologists.
No.
You mean a higher rank.
Okay. So the book talks about this, and this is where it becomes interesting. How does this ordinary, and this is what the book's about. You can fail, but if you dig deep enough and you think, well, what role did I have in that failure and how do I improve that?
Right.
How do I build my resilience?
Yeah.
How do I build my skills? How do I build my reputation? How do I build good relationships, truly honest relationships?
Mm.
How does that person that's failing, that firstly tells last chance, Helen, how does that person become the police commander of the Mossman Collar Bomb?
Yeah.
And how does that person then become the forward police commander of the first 2 hours of the Link Cafe? How does that person, if I'd have given up, I would have never had the opportunity to influence and be part of the change that we did in homelessness.
If somebody picks up the book and look at it objectively, it's very difficult for you to do because you're involved. It's about you.
Yeah.
But if somebody was to look at the book objectively, they'd be able to pinpoint. Sorry, I lose my voice. They'd be able to pinpoint exactly the journey that Alan Sickhart has been on from
for
those 40 years.
You can see it.
Yeah.
So and this is the powerful thing about writing a book. So when you interviewed me back in
2011.
No, when you interviewed me just as I was about to retire, about March 2020.
Yeah.
I think I told you then I wanted to write a book.
Yeah. It was in your blood.
Yeah, and but when you've never written a book before, my first version was pretty well crap. Hopefully the readers don't say my last version is crap as well, but it was crap.
Right.
And I had another go, and the second version was crap as well. So then I got advice about to seek a coach.
There were such people.
Or people that are experts in this field. So I found this lady. She was recommended to me. She was called Kelly Irving.
Yeah.
And she's the leader, the person behind what's called the Expert Author Academy. She has 100% success rate of published books. She introduces you. You've become part of this community, so you're supported by other people such as yourself writing their first book.
Right.
She put me with one of my best friends now, a bloke called Peter Scott, the Commodore of the Australian Submarine Fleet. He's just writing his book, gets released at the end of this week, called Running Deep.
Yeah.
So you end up being supported by people on the same journey, doing the same kind of thing, and then you end up forming a structure around a book that people might read, And what she suggested, Alan, what you've produced so far doesn't make sense, but if you went back to the start and wrote it like a memoir in three parts, and she suggested the three parts, I think it was New and Naive, Earning Your Stripes, and then I came up with the last one, Learning from the Past and Paying It Forward.
Okay.
Yeah, so they're the three.
So does that mean the last chapter, have you done the last chapter yet?
Yeah, it's all done.
So does the last chapter then summarise everything that's happened throughout the book, or no?
How it works is at the end of every chapter, there's a reflection section. So I talk about, like the first chapter is when I first tried to join. And I won't give it away.
Okay.
But the reflection section is kind to 18-year-old Alan Sicard. Because how many of us know what we're doing when we're 18?
Sure.
And so that's kind of the reflections.
In my era, the guys were going off to Vietnam.
Yes, yes, yeah. Well, in the police, we're all, at 19, we're given a gun.
Yeah.
Correct. And can arrest anyone if we wanted to,
yeah.
With our discretion. So the book goes down. So the last chapter to answer that, it's called The Courage to Create New Beginnings. And that's along the decision to retire, and then what I'm going to do when I retire, and it's because it's not the end.
I can't see you retiring ever.
That's a good segue into it. So my hot button in the police, and it always was, from the last 20 years of my career, I learnt that I wanted to create other leaders. And I'd read this quote somewhere, the true measure of a leader is how many other leaders they create. So I embarked on this journey of creating leadership workshops every year. The first year, it's in the book, I did it outside of police hours because they'd never...
In your own time.
In my own time. So we did it at a council chambers after work, and six people volunteered to be part of that course.
Right.
So I did that. And then the next year it took off.
Were they people that you worked with?
Yeah. It was in the local police station. People that volunteered to be part of it, and assistant commissioners and deputy commissioners came and gave lectures to that because I knew them. I've been around a while, and CEOs of other big organisations came because I knew them from something else. After that year, where I did it in my own time, and everyone, it just took off and it became a mainstream thing. So that was I learnt so much from all the people. It was in those leadership workshops, and I did that for the last 15 years at a superintendent rank. And I didn't have to. It wasn't a prerequisite. It was just something I was committed to try and switch a light on to people what's possible if you go down this path of empowering others to lead. So that's my hot button. And then when I left, this is what this is a segue into the last chapter. So how do I keep that going when I leave? So I left because I honestly couldn't. I won't spoil the book in this part. So read the book to find out why I left. But then I found out that there was another way that I could replicate the leadership workshops, where I created the podcast, the Courage to Lead interview series, where I interviewed other leaders that I knew had the skills or the created the culture.
People
where,
that you trusted.
Yeah. A lot of them have been guest lecturers on those leadership workshops over the last 15 years. Others I'd learnt through, like I interviewed the submarine guy.
Yeah.
And we just clicked from day one. But I learnt that the Courage to Lead interview series could shine a light on leaders who empower others to create supportive and inclusive workplaces where people can do their absolute best, because this is not the norm. We hear so often in media that we have leaders that hurt people.
Sure.
We have,
and they think that they're leaders, but they're not.
Yeah, and there's data out at the moment. It's at least $90 million, it could be $98 million between 2009 and 2020 of people who were paid for being hurt at a mental level in a workplace in Australia.
Wow.
So, So we still, I interviewed someone recently the other day, and we all probably remember Peter Drucker, the management expert. Yeah. So he's one of his greatest sayings is culture eats strategy for breakfast. So all I'm doing in the interview series is I'm picking the eyes out of leaders who I know or who I've learned.
Do you know each of those persons personally?
Most of them I have, but I'm starting to get approached by others that
they're
that I've never heard of before.
That's
fabulous. Yeah, so I've interviewed that. And once you get...
Just tease us. Give us some of the names that are on there.
One of the ones that I love is, I've already talked about, Trina Jones, the CEO of Homelessness New South Wales. I think she's only maybe 32, 33. Young, like, she did the interview in a car at 8 o'clock at night after she put the kids to bed. One of the other.
That was her studio.
Yeah, and she killed it. She's just such a beautiful. Like the stories, the interviews go into how do these people get made, and that's what you said about the book, my book.
Yeah.
The interview tries to show people how these people get made to be kind and caring leaders that actually knock the socks off. I interviewed Carlene York.
Yeah.
The commissioner of the
SES.
Yeah, State Emergency Services.
Who used to be. Was she assistant commissioner?
Yes, in the New South Wales Police. So her story was just amazing.
Yeah.
But it came out how kind she was.
Yeah.
And their ethos. And one of the best ones that I love, that probably not many people, it's got a few, but she gives me the testimonial on the front cover of my book, Rebecca Pinkstone. So she's the CEO of Bridge Housing.
Okay.
One of the prolific community housing providers that aims to solve homelessness. And her story is the same. It's just and what I didn't know going into the interview, but as you've done, you've researched the internet for me. So I researched the internet for her, and there was a photo of her and her husband because I worked for her husband. Worked with her husband in homelessness.
Yeah.
And then it had this spiel that Rebecca Bridge Housing had been awarded the Best Workplace of Choice Awards for 3 years in a row. And then now it's 5 years in a row. So she talks about that in the interview. So I want people, like the beauty of the podcast is that anyone with an internet connection can choose whether they want to listen to it or not.
Sure.
But I want people to know you don't have to work for an organisation that hurts you. There's organisations out there now that make it a priority to make them an organisation of choice. And we don't know that. I can see the look on your face. You didn't know that. So I'm trying to shine a light on people that do this. So the guy that approached me out of the blue that I never ever heard of, a bloke in Singapore, a bloke called Nick Johnson, and he's Swedish, so Johnson's Jonsson.
Oh, yeah.
He's written a book called Executive Loneliness. So, you know, and I didn't understand all this. When you're an expat... in those countries, you essentially stay in your own circle, and it's quite lonely, and you're responsible for big dollars. So he,
I would imagine the same being Hong Kong.
Yes. So he was Hong Kong, Singapore, Vietnam. Yeah. I'd never heard of him, but it came out of the blue, and then I researched him. I thought, oh God, you've got the story that needs to be heard. So he was this high flying executive. But eating himself up inside at a mental level, and at a personal level and a health level, relationship level, in a really bad way. And I won't give it away because his book's a good book and the interview is a good interview. But he ends up creating this thing called ESG. So I think it's supposed to stand for Executive Support Group. So he has created this community of people at that level, that CEO level, that can't talk to anyone. They sign off on a non-disclosure agreement.
Right.
And they get around a table once a week, once a fortnight, and support each other at that level.
It's called camaraderie.
Yeah. So I like some...
You and I are big on camaraderie.
Yes.
We want it to happen. It's sort of from the bottom, the push upwards.
Mm.
Yeah. We're running out of time.
Yeah, right. Go.
Maybe go up there because my interviews are so long, but I just get so absorbed in what you do. I'm going to throw this in while I'm looking for my other question. Can you remember who your first arrest was?
Not the name.
The incident? Are we talking 1980?
1980s, yeah. It's in the book.
And the music that was playing on the background?
It was at the Coogee Bay Hotel. it's the second chapter of the book. Called Who's Next?
Okay. This is Jeff Sandwine, right out Northern Beaches, 88.7 and 90.3, and I'm delighted to have in the studio Noel Prynne. Superintendent Alan Sickard from North Shore Police Area Command at one stage, but he was also involved in another thing. I suppose we can't gloss over it, but the collar bomb, that was a bit of a, can we say, a bit of an awake thing?
It was the...
I know it's a media sensation at the time, but were you conscious of that when you were involved in the collar bomb thing, or no?
You
were just doing your job.
I was just doing my job, and I think that's... there's a whole chapter on this in the book, so I don't want to kind of give some more, but it was Australia's first exposure to what might happen.
Terrorism.
Yeah, so yeah. Terrorism. It probably was an eye-opener to me. Like, I just went and did what I do. The way I describe it is create an environment where people can do their best.
Okay.
So that doesn't mean I'm the star. I just create the environment where what I found in a job like that, the best of the best come to help.
Yeah. What were you down there at the scene?
So I heard it. It was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I was in my office doing the minutiae of what commanders are supposed to do with the correspondence that we all hate. I heard it come over the air, and I thought that's a real job.
Yeah.
So again, I called my bosses. I said I'm on the way to this. They gave me some advice because it was a young 18-year-old woman with a with a device around her neck with instructions about what not to do.
Madeline
Pulver. So Bill Pulver was her dad that used to be in Australian Rugby Union fame. So I let them know. The power of seeking and consulting with other people. The person I rang said, "Al, you probably should ring the negotiators. And it's not their job."
Were there negotiators in 2011?
Yeah, they were quite well known. So, but their job wasn't to help. And why I wanted the negotiators was to help calm down Madeline Pulver. How do you leave an 18-year-old woman with a device around her neck on her own?
Yeah.
And we already had, as we know, as the story is pretty well known, Senior Constable Karen Loudon.
In those days, was there a CT division of police?
Yes.
Counterterrorism had already been established.
Yeah, so that's a good backstory, and that's in the chapter. So what happens is, like I've just shared with you, that Alan Sickard up until that point was probably pretty well known for failing. So Alan Sickard's now the police commander of the Mossman collar bomb.
Right.
What I didn't know...
Which the whole world is facing.
What I didn't know, I was naive to, was that the New South Wales Police want to be assured that the police commander of the job is up for the job.
And he's got his marbles.
So, what happens is, my boss, Mark Murdoch, Assistant Commissioner Mark Murdoch, comes to the job. And he brings with him the whole cadre of the counter-terrorism response to the job.
Did you welcome that?
No, but
maybe you shouldn't answer that.
I learnt to control what I can control and just get on. But I was given the instruction, Al, you've got the job until the device is declared a real device.
Okay.
So it never was. But we all thought it was.
Yeah.
And we all lived in the environment that it was.
Well, you've got it.
Yeah. Well, the bomb, I learned from that job, and that's why it was so critical in the Link Cafe. Once we learned that it was potentially a bomb...
That was one of my questions. Yeah. Can you see the link between the two?
Oh, they were huge.
Yeah.
So, I don't go into the book because it's kind of confidential in police methodology. There's a number of steps that you have to do to prove something's not a bomb. So we did all that in the Mossman collar bomb. And they were in the process of doing that in the Link Cafe as well. So,
okay. I saw a thing that that the coroner published orders to suppress your comments or something.
My comments?
Yeah, no, it was, it might have been to do with the negotiations that were going on at the time. It might have just have been a brief thing for a couple of days whilst when the hearing was on in court. Don't worry about it.
I don't know whether it was that order might have been around the bomb.
Might have been.
Because there was, there's a number of steps. So the, I haven't read what they said.
Okay.
about me.
Okay, we're
going
to have to let you go.
Yeah.
But tell us about beekeeping.
Beekeeping, yeah. So one of the things...
Alan Sickard, ex-superintendent and commander of the North Shore Police Area Command, is into beekeeping.
Yeah, so when I left, when I made the decision to retire, I just had the ambition that enjoy my family as much as I can, but learn as many new things as I can. So I took up beekeeping. And there's a thing...
About no experience previously?
Never, never no seen it. No. But there's this new system called the Flow Hive system. So this father and son team, Cedar and his dad, I can't remember his dad's name, up in Lismore,
right.
They created this system where the super part where the honey gets made, traditionally the wax gets all squashed and spun bees die in that process. So they came up with this system that you virtually have a plastic frame that's capable of having a tube down the bottom of it and virtually a handle system at the top that will let you pour the honey out into a jar. Yeah, so there's six...
Without removing the...
The bees are still there. You're not hurting them at all. Yeah. And so they...
Are you fully kitted up?
Yeah, yeah. You can, if you're someone like these...
Is this an expensive exercise, beekeeping?
The flow hive system is about $1,000 to $1,200 each hive, whereas the normal hive is only about $200
or $300. You're
going
to have to go back
in
the police and get some money,
Mike. Yeah. So you out of that, it's the most cathartic thing you'll ever do is spending 2 hours just filling up your jars of honey. And I'll bring you some because I've got quite a few at home. And it tastes like nothing else you've ever tasted because each frame...
What I read was that a lot of the honey that you buy in the supermarkets has been treated with additives and things like that, whereas yours is pure.
Pure, totally pure.
Absolutely pure. Do you know where the bees have been? What sort of plants have they been?
Well, we live, my wife found the most beautiful property in Castle. It's 5,000 square metre, just bush block, and she's planted hundreds of natives. So the most of it comes from our place. But you can see the beauty about the flow hive system is there's six frames, and each frame could be from a different flower, and they're a different colour, they're a different taste, and it's exquisite. So if you want something cathartic to do with your life, and just funny as an aside, I just spoke to my friend who was one of the main commanders of the Link Cafe.
Yeah.
He's bought a flow hive system as well.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So if I come to your place for breakfast, I'm going to have honey on toast.
The best honey ever.
Or honey on my cornflakes or something.
Yeah, honey, after you have taste this honey, you just have it out of the bottle. It's just... I'm quite often having a spoonful of it. It's just that good.
I can't remember. So one of my colleagues at another radio station interviewed the Northern Beaches or the Northern something Hives Association or Beekeeping Association, I think it was.
Yeah.
They've said exactly the same thing that you have. It is extremely cathartic and time-wasting.
Mm, that's wonderful. Yeah. It really is wonderful. And then... If you ask me, am I fully kitted up? Yes, because if they seem to know if I get overconfident, I get stung. Whereas some people,
have you been stung?
Oh yes, you wouldn't even know my face.
Really?
Yeah. My kids didn't even know. Is that you?
What happens from the sting?
Not huge, but they're insane at knowing.
That's why you're growing the beard.
They're insane at knowing aiming for your face. So they either get you on the lip or the nose or the throat. So if I get stung in the throat, I just put an ice pack on it and have some periactin to settle it down. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I want you to come back.
Yeah, no, and I'll bring a you just want another bottle of honey, so I'll bring out a bottle of honey.
give me your last song. What do you want to go up and down? I remember that you were a Red Hot Chili Peppers man.
No, it's Nickelback. My fight song was Burn It to the Floor.
Burn it to the ground.
Burn it to the ground, yes.
From Nickelback. Here we go. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You will come back.
Yeah.
Nickelback, with Chris Dolan, our guest, ex-superintendent Alan Sicard. Looking forward to having you back, my friend. Cheers.
Thank you.